Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right, right thing. Now. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now, right now.
That's right, that's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live at Harris Stowe State University, our HBCU. And anything that we say on this show is not necessarily the position or viewpoints of the Black Radio Hall of Fame or Harris Stowe State University. But we hope that you will get some information today. We are in election season, and so we have to get all the information we can to be an informed voter. And so I have extended the invitation to all of the people who are running for the mayor's office, which is the top office in the city. I had two responses, one from Mayor Jones, the incumbent, and one from Mike Butler. So Mike Butler was supposed to have two other candidates jarring tonight, but they are not here. So we're going to be able to take a deeper dive with him. And that's all good for me. I don't, you give people the opportunity, they take it or they don't. So Mike, I want to welcome you to the show. You haven't been a guest before, so I'm excited about that.
Welcome. I'm excited to be here too. I'm excited for the conversation with such a pillar.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to start with talking about where you come from, because I think for somebody like you who's done a lot, this you got a couple of firsts in your repertoire, and we want to talk about that. So are you from a family that's politically involved, or are you just an anomaly about public service?
I am not from a political family. I'm the first person to be elected in my family's history. I come from a family of union members, mostly. My grandfather was a Teamster. My grandparents taught in St. Louis public schools on my mother's side. My grandfather, my dad's side was a Teamster. On my mother's side, they were members of AFT Local 420. My dad is a union printer. He was a member of Communication Workers of America for decades. And I was a teacher, and I was a member of AFT Local 420. And I have a sister who's a member of AFT Local 420. I got into politics. I'll tell the story because we get to talk. I love to talk. I met Freeman Bozzi Sr. when I was graduating from high school. And I was working at my dad's union shop. And I had always wanted to get into politics. I tell a story about a baseball game, but the foray for me when I really decided I definitely wanted to run for public office, Freeman Bozzi Sr. came and met my dad. And it's Freeman Bozzi Sr. I kind of struggled with conversation with him. And I at the time I wanted to go to college to be an attorney, a corporate lawyer. And Freeman said, "Why do you want to be a lawyer?"
He said, "I can just hear him now."
A lawyer put a man in a jail. A politician like me, go get him out. And I said, and he talked to me for some time about power and how power is better to change our community than I want to be like a lawyer to help people, defend folks and be a civil rights lawyer. And he was pretty much saying you could do it much better, much easier if you get into politics. And that really stuck with me. And by the time I was graduating college, I realized I didn't need a law degree or even a bachelor's degree, even a high school diploma to run for office. There was no reason for me to go to law school because I still was thinking about that, going to law school as I went through college and got a business management degree. And my mother's an attorney, and I really was inspired by her. And I wanted to be just like my mom and go to law school, but she told me to get a business degree and it'll give me more opportunities outside of undergrad. So I'll end by saying, I tell a story. I got into politics. I played a baseball game as a kid. I played at Herbert Hoover Boys and Girls Club. And I was playing against a team that I knew was cheating. And that team was going up into second base to cleats up, and I was a shortstop, so it really bothered me. And going to third base, they throw dirt in the air and keep me from getting a ground ball. And I don't like to say the name of this team, but the team's name does rhyme with Schmathews and Schmicky. And Schmicky folks love to hear me say that they won that game that day. And they beat us so bad that I cried to my dad and I said, "Dad, it's not fair. You said that cheaters never win." My dad gave me that age-old line. He said, "Son, life isn't fair." And I remember that day. That's when I first got my foray into, like, I think I want to know people like Freeman Senior and Freeman Junior. Like, I want to make life fair for everyone. I want to be a leader that makes sense. That's the same thing that made me think about going to law school. I want to make life fair for everyone. And I feel like, and as mayor, I'm driven to run for this position because I want to make the city government more fair for everyone.
Okay, but you had some stops along the way. You were a state rep. You worked for Robin right before as an aide. So talk a little bit about the things that on the way that you think have shaped you for the position that you want to go for right now.
I can't thank you enough for that because that's what being a mother in our community is about. People don't ask us that mostly. They want to know, what can you do for me today? Thank you for asking me this. I worked in corporate America after I graduated from college. I decided not to go to law school. I went and worked in corporate America for a while. I worked at a little company called Walmart Stores Incorporated in Bentonville, and I hated the job. I absolutely hated it. My plan was to make a lot of money, learn business, and then run for office. Because my thing was, you can never, I'm not going to be bought. So I want to make some money. And then when I go run for office, then can't nobody buy me, can't nobody do nothing. So I was working in corporate America and I had a lunch with one of my fraternity brothers. I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. And this guy was an attorney. He was a director at Walmart. He was making great money. And I was telling him, he said, "What do you want to do with your life? You're 24 years old working here in Bentonville. What do you want to do?" And I told him, I want to go back home and run for office and lead my city. When I want to make my city better." And he told me that day at lunch, he said, "If that's what you want to do, you need to quit today." He says, "Get out of
Wow.
here." He says, "Before you get a wife and a kid here and fall in love, like, get out of here, Mike." And that's really what made me say, he said, "You don't need money to have integrity." Okay. He was like, "You can make some great money here, but you're gonna get stuck, and but at the same time, you have everything you need." So he instructed me, he said, "You should go try to be a staffer. Maybe it's somewhere in city hall or at state government." And he really had me looking into different options of how to get to a position of power to improve my city. And I decided to go to graduate school. I applied for graduate school and I started out as an intern in the state legislature. And after my internship was over, I was picked up as a legislative aide by the state rep that I interned for. And that's when I met Robin Wright Jones. Robin Wright Jones kind of stole me from that state rep to work for her in the state Senate. I was quiet as kept. I was one of three African American males in the state house. Staffing, like hundreds of staffers in State House, only three African American males. And I think Robin at the time wanted somebody young and dynamic. And
Energetic.
yes, and she took me from the State House. And I gotta say, that those were my was one of my best jobs. I loved being a staffer. I loved serving an elected official. I loved learning in that way. I loved learning how to have integrity, how to do things right. John Bowman was was the chief of staff. He was my direct boss at the time, and so I got to meet a lot of different people and learn the process. And I fell in love with state government. My original plan was to go to graduate school, come back to the city, and run for alderman, because at the time my hero was Casey Starr Triplett. She was a young alderwoman,
I remember Casey.
who was very well liked and very popular. Chris Carter was a state rep at the time, so he was someone I really looked up to, Chris Carter Jr. And Don Calloway was a state representative at the time. He was out of San Diego. So I had a lot of young, I mean, Tashar Jones was also in the state house. I had a lot of young people to look up to. And I fell in love with state politics mostly because of Don, Chris, and Tashar. and I decided to run for state representative when my actual divine intervention happened, when my actual state house seat that I grew up in South City came open, because Tashar ran for city treasurer, and it was a vacant seat that was a newly redistricted and had my home, my North City childhood home, and both my South City childhood home in the same district. And it just the rest is history. I ran for the office. I was outraised by my opponent, $80,000 to 12, and I still won by 24%, because the people believed in me. North City showed up for me hugely, and we just listened to what the issues of the city were, and we listened to listen to solutions from people who were closest to the problem. And I've kept that same demeanor and kept that same thought process throughout my career.
Well, you say that your opponent outspent you. I always like for people to underscore that, because money is not always the bottom line. It's how well you organize and what you're coming into the race with, and obviously for you is integrity and credibility, which there's no price on that, So that's interesting. Now, you also made history because you were the first Black person to head up the Recorder of Deeds office, and then you were the first Black to head up the Missouri Democratic Party. So I'm going to start with the party first. What indelible mark do you think you made on that? Because whenever somebody is the first of anything, so everybody's looking at them. What's going to be their legacy? What are they going to do differently to put us on like a new, pathway? What do you think you left for the state party? Now, I could say that whatever you left for them, they rolled over it, because I don't see anything they're
Yes,
doing now.
and
But
that's what I was saying. Not to disparage anybody who's working at the party now. I don't think I unfortunately don't feel like I left a legacy that is something that has been repeated. I was the state party chair for 2 years. If I had been there longer, there were some things that I wanted to do in that second term. But I can tell you what I did do, and what I would hope that future Black leaders and future leaders, any leader in the Democratic Party, will repeat. And that's one thing, is that to focus on the Black community, as far as Democrats, focus on the Black community. When I became Democratic Party chair, the St. Louis American was not a part of our media list. One of the reasons some people didn't last in positions at the party, after Joe Biden had just won an election where the Black community in South Carolina and across the country revived this new president's career and put him into the White House, the members of the state committee did realize that, and then elected for the first time an African American leader in me. But when I got to the staff, they hadn't seen or learned that lesson at all. And I would hope that staff members in the future would learn that there's not one campaign or one district in this state that is not won by Democrats without the help of Black people in that district. Democrats go to every single state rep, state senate district, any statewide district, and they expect the Black folks, whether it's 100 people, 50 people, or 100,000, to swing towards them. So that means you've got to respect our community and listen to voices that are leading that community, and hire voices that lead the community. The second thing I did as the Democratic Party chair is I hired the first openly gay African American executive director, and I paid him more than anyone in that position I ever made. So I increased salaries in that position, in every position. I hired African Americans in every position I could, and I made sure we got experienced people, not just political cronies or people who had been part of a last campaign. There's a culture in Democratic politics to say, "Oh, Claire McCaskill just won election. Who do you, Claire, who do you want to work for the party now? We'll find a place for them." Rather than to look at a composition and say, "Hey, let's find someone who has worked in a newsroom, who has relationships all around news, and knows how media is changing. How do we make sure we put someone in a position that is professional? And how do we create the salaries that compete with the professional class?" I think that's what I hope my legacy would be, that we absolutely professionalize the Democratic Party. And even with a super minority in a midterm, We beat the brakes off the Republicans. We went through the biggest thing that I did do that's lasting though. I do not remember. I was the state party chair during redistricting, and at the end of that redistricting, we had the largest Black caucus in the history of the state, and we protected every African American district and added a couple. And that didn't come easy. That did not come easy.
Oh, I bet. I
And
bet.
had a little infighting with even not negative infight, but had some reminding of my own staff sometime of what me and the executive director's desires were. We were me and the executive director were both former state representatives who had also been staffers. He was a staffer for Congressman Clay previous to coming to the party, and I, of course, have been a staffer in the state legislature. We understood how to work with staff, but also say, hey, this is important to our community that we're growing the base and that we're making districts that are building a bigger Black caucus. That's more Democrats. And we also had districts that were more Democrats. We had the Republicans and every step of the way, even though they had the governorship, they were unprepared for how organized we were, how much we knew about the process, because both me and the state representative who I hired for executive director had went through the districting process as state representatives. And we really showcased just how experienced our folks can be as politicians, but also as staff people working for a greater good.
Well, I think it's a tragedy then that the lesson of how do you build a base among your Black Democratic voters and show them respect at every election cycle. Because what I hear now and what I'm seeing now is, people weary of being taken advantage of by the Democratic Party, and in some cases just not showing up. So, and that's not what we want. We want people to fully participate in the process. Although I'm always one to say voting is not the end. Voting is a means to the end. When I think about the Democrats, I just think there's so many missed opportunities, both on the state level and the federal level. But let's talk about what you're doing in the office that you have now, because at one of the candidates forum, the mayor even acknowledged that she had utilized it and it was quick and easy. And I know that was one of your things to actually, get things professionalized and computerized. And so what have you done there that you can also hang your hat on and say, because I'm a big believer, Michael, is that when you try to get a promotion, you got to show what you did
Yes.
at this level, and then we can say, oh yeah, he did a great job there, so he needs to we need to promote him. And so first of all, what is the role of the Recorder of Deeds office? What do you do as the head of it, and what do people expect when they come to that office?
The Recorder of Deeds office is an elected administrator that is in charge of all the land deeds, the birth certificates, death certificates, and marriage licenses in City Hall. So I'm in charge of a bunch of important documents and making sure they're available. So when you need them, when you come and get them, that you can access those documents. The biggest thing that I wanted to do as recorder was bring our office online and make sure that you don't have to go to City Hall if you want to access your city government. I believe that in 2025, you should be able to, just like you access your bank account online, you can access your social media online, you should be able to access every part of your government online. And we were able to accomplish that. All of our services online, and you can, but if you do come into the office, we renovated our office for in-person customers. There was one thing that I did was there was a process that was like an old soda fountain, I like to say like an old soda fountain confectionery, where there was about 20% customer space and 80% space for the workers in our office. And you'd have to get your deed in one room and then go and pay for it in another room and then come back with your receipt and pick it up from the person you paid for with. I got rid of all that. I was like, yeah, 2020, it was about 2019. Like, we can change that. So we put all what I call all of our customer-facing functions into one room, which we tied up the Recorder's Assistance Center. And we dressed it up like and renovated it like a T-Mobile store. So it looks much different, more futuristic. And we provide services for all of our land deeds, and you pay for it all in one room. And what that has done with the online services and the in-person services for folks who want to come to City Hall, we've increased our revenue by $700,000 a year. That's about 20% of our annual budget. And we increase productivity by 25%. So we've been We've been working hard and we've gotten a lot of success, and I want to build on success and bring that success to the rest of City Hall.
So how did you do that? How did you get 700,000 more? That's almost $1 million.
Yes, it's been good. A good economy through some of those years. So more deed usage was a part of it, but also our easy access. We have a quick turnaround. And we've heard from a lot of real estate attorneys and folks in real estate that we got a much quicker turnaround and more efficient than other offices. So people are making title companies, or it's easier to do transactions with us. So we've kept a lot of that high in the land deeds office, but we also get more transactions online for our marriage license, our birth certificates, and our death certificates, especially birth and marriage licenses. People access our office from all over the city, and in some cases from other parts of the region, in order to get their marriage license, and we make more sales in that way. We have
Tell me this though. This is starting to sound like a place that there could be some fraud. So, if I want my marriage license, what do I need to do online? Because I can't see you all, like, whatever document I'm giving you is going to be okay, because people like make up documents.
People were nervous about it at first. So we use two-step verification to verify you are who you say you are, just like you do with your bank account or any other thing online. We also you order online, and we double check our records and public records to make sure we're sending it to the right person when we actually mail it to you. So and we also use an online company called Vital Check, which is for birth records. And death records that the state has always used. So you'll utilize that when you're ordering those birth and death records online. But no, we don't have near as much fraud that people think we do. Now, there is some deed fraud from time to time. And I can talk about that because that's been in the news for cities and counties all across the country. And we've learned to get the most stringent deed fraud parameters, because what we do is we check people's licenses when they come in person. We make sure we keep a copy of the license, so if there's any issue, we can provide who came in person to the police, as well as we're able to double check. Because that was a problem before I became recorder, that there'd be some deed fraud and you wouldn't even know who the person was, who the actual person was that came in, because you just have a fake signature. The biggest thing we've done, we've changed, is we double check notaries. Notaries are throughout the process, they're supposed to validate people's identity. In
Right
those
in
public
front of
notaries,
you. Right.
correct. But
Right.
sometimes that doesn't happen. As recorders, we know some people sometimes get fake old notary things, or fake or fake not or use fake notaries who are not there. People who do some fraud and are don't have both people right in front of them. So we're just supposed to intake the information. But now we make sure that we're double checking to make sure that notary is correct, and that you're not just bringing us a document in person that is fraudulent. And we have been re really been able to decrease deed fraud in our city, and we've been able to forward any issues that we find to the police. And I can tell you, the police department has been on top of more of these fraudulent cases than they have been in the past.
No, with the deed fraud, the changes that you've made, is that a result of the two high profile cases that were
Yes.
profiled on Channel 2?
Yes, they are. When Elliot Davis came and first interviewed me, we let him know what our responsibility was as an office. But after I saw his response, I decided it was time for us to take more responsibility. And I think, to your point, I took that as a leader and said, hey, and I had a meeting with all my staff and said, hey, we could push back on this and say what other people do and what in property fraud, or we can take responsibility of what we see people want us to do, and we can change some of our practices. And the biggest and we changed our notary practice. No other county in the state does that, double checks notaries. We got more stringent on our checking IDs. We actually keep those copies longer to make sure that we're providing something to the police department if something happens. And we kind of pushed the police department detectives to be on top of the case we provide them more. We said, hey, you saw the news, and we want to make sure that we're not just sending you stuff that you're actually responding back, and people are being able to see the results. Because the first thing that Miss Bernadette Brown did, she said she went to the police and the police did nothing. Then she came to us and put pressure on us. So we heard her. We started to put that pressure back on the police as well, who are the investigative body. So of course, 99.8% of our transactions still are absolutely fine, but we got to take responsibility and do more. And a leader, people want to see what a leader does when one of their employees or their office or their responsibility in a sense be seen as making a mistake. And I think that I've learned from that that what citizens want is that for us to be mature and to improve.
That's encouraging to hear because when I saw those episodes, you did sound a bit defensive. But the fact that you then thought about it and looked at the fact, well, they absolutely right. I do have a responsibility. So how were those two particular situations resolved? Was there, did it get resolved for in favor of the folks who were screwed?
One went to a court case, and I think the Miss Brown and Mr. Brown was the defendant. I think they, my understanding, they settled out of court. I'm not sure what happened with the other. I don't think he actually went to a case. His thing was his name was spelled wrong or something. So I think we, I
Whoever
could be one of them as
whoever
well.
scammed him didn't know his name and they put his first name last and that's and he his thing was that should have been a tip off to the office that something was wrong.
Well, yeah, that's what he said, but that happens quite a bit, quite often. Like people do write their names that way, and yeah, that happens. That so we've learned to ask more questions when if that occurs, but people
And
do
see,
write
I
their
think
names
Michael
that
is
way.
important for folks in positions like yours to be able to self-correct when needed and not just hold on to the fact that somebody's trying to make me look bad because you are a public service, your office is there for people to deal with. And here is somebody who told you, I went to the police first, they did nothing. I mean, when people just get so disgusted with City Hall and government services because nobody's serving, nobody wants to be serving the public. So you have to do more work as a citizen, when there's something wrong, because there's nobody really willing and able to help you, and I think that is something that definitely needs to be turned around in city government. That whenever you step into office, you got somebody ready, willing, and pleasant about serving you. So,
Yes. And as a servant, sometimes the solution is not given as much attention in the media as the problem was, as I've had in this case. And what I've learned is that that's just part of the job, and that's just part of having power, is that you've got to take those on the chin. If I may, I like to say you got to learn how to eat shit. You got as a leader. And
That's a
when you
certain amount of
finish,
humility that comes with the job.
yes, it is. And
And
I'll
I
say
think when
that.
that happens and people see that, they really appreciate that because it's not about you. It's about like the bigger picture and the majority of folks. And so when people see that you're trying to protect your own ego, they start to draw conclusions. And then that's when they just become hardcore. Then when you get ready to do something else, like, oh yeah, I remember him. He didn't. I hear that so much about people that are running. Somebody's got a story about what that person didn't do when they asked them. And I'm like, it's seared into their psyche. Like they didn't help me. And I don't care what they running for now, I'm gonna oppose them. I'm like, really, this is bigger than you too, my friend. So yeah, I just want one question, more question about that 700,000, because I know a little bit about how city it works. So then do they take that off of your budget because you brought in 700,000? And so you basically are funding the office by the office?
So our office is funded through the city budget process. So all that extra money goes directly to general revenue. Now the budget committee does give us a budget allocation every year. They have increased our budget allocation because as they've seen we're bringing in more money, they say, oh yeah, okay, you can increase your expenses a little bit. So they never give us more than what we spend. They never let us spend more than what we take in. In the past, when I first became recorder, our office was actually spending more than it took in. And I've been blessed that since I've been recorder, we've always given the city back more than what we spent.
And then that definitely is a selling point when you get ready to run for another office. So, what are you running for, mayor? What do you think you could do differently than the folks who are in there now and even who've been in there in the past? And what's your vision for the city?
So I'll start by saying, of course, I want to make the city more fair for everyone. And what that means to me is I want to continue to reduce crime. I also want to improve our schools and improve the way the city government can support our schools. I want to, what really my vision and biggest thing that gets me up in the morning is reducing vacant housing in our city. I want the biggest eyesore in our city to go away, which is demolishing the thousands of LRA properties that we have across the city. As well, and building new infill housing within those on those lots, or renovating LRA property that can be renovated, so we can transform and have a North City and parts of South City look a lot different. And I'm gonna use RAND's money to do that. And then lastly, of course, I want to bring our city back to the basics. I want to provide those basic city services, like I've done in the Recorder D's office, much better and to our citizens, so that they feel like they're getting their tax dollars worth from the city government.
I want to step back a bit with the education piece because here's a thing that some people mistakenly think that the mayor has control over the school board. And in fact, sometimes they think the mayor appoints the superintendent. So there is some boundaries there in terms of what you can or cannot do. So when you say supporting, education, what exactly do you mean?
What I mean is, I want to use RAND's funding to support wraparound services for 20 low-income schools in our city. And the city has done this before. When I was in the state legislature, the city gave about $1 million a year to community education. And there was a community education program in the state SLPS for quite some time. And what wraparound services means is funding a full-time social worker in every low-income school, a full-time nurse, because there are a lot of schools that aren't a full-time nurse. And I want to add a full-time therapist. Our kids are going through so many things mentally, and our community talks about the need for mental health for so much over the past decade. I want to make sure that our kids have those three things that they can access and have greater partnerships with in their school building for all the social worker needs that they all the social needs they need through a social worker. Of course, having health access to a nurse, and then having mental health access to a therapist. And so we all know the effects of therapy and the effects of poverty on student achievement is negative. And we know that about 30% of our student population SLPS are dealing with housing insecurity. The city government can help out with that. About the same amount of students are dealing with food insecurity. The city government can help out with that. 74% of SLPS students are at or below the poverty line. And so the city government can help out with that, reducing the effects of poverty on their student achievement. And I would dig deeper and put money towards that and make sure we're committing to doing that a longer term after 5 years, and trying to get state and federal money to fill in after the 5 years is up from the RAND's
So
money.
the unhoused students, that's been a persistent issue for a while, and it doesn't seem to be it doesn't seem to have been resolved effectively. I'm wondering from your standpoint, what would be the thing that you would do differently now to get those folks in housing? Because there's already some gaps in unhoused people, let alone, students and their families. So if that's the issue that we haven't closed the gap with, how do you expect to close it for the kids who need a safe place to sleep and lay their heads, do their homework? So what would you do differently?
So this is very personal to me, because I was a transient kid myself. Between when my parents got divorced when I was 9, between the ages of 9 and 18, I lived in six different places, and I went to about seven different schools. So I was a nomad as well. And transient, being a transient, transient populations in our city is something that's all too common. So what we can do to help out in the city government, of course, we're working with social workers, health issues and health regulations for where a lot of these kids are living, which were in places where we would have called them tenement houses back in the day. There's still of them in our city. We need to make sure that we are providing separate housing, new emergency housing for students in the city. And public housing and letting people get into temporary emergency housing and then public housing, then through the St. Louis Housing Authority, as quickly as possible, so that folks aren't stuck in this low income, unhealthy, high environmental risk housing. That's number one. And then two, we've got to make sure that there are times where we're implementing rent control and or rent subsidies for parents who can't sometimes afford the housing that they're in when they fall on hard times, or when they get a divorce, or when they have in most times a life event. We've got to be sure to partner with nonprofit organizations and social workers that are getting those parents the help they need in real time, so that they don't have to move so much. What you find a lot in, especially in St. Louis City, when I was a teacher, I dealt with this. There were a few kids that took taxis to shelters in the county or in other parts of St. Louis City that weren't nowhere near close to Ashland Elementary School where I taught. And I could feel for those kids where sometimes they had a tough day at school, and that meant they were gonna have a tough night because they weren't sleeping in their own bed. So when a family finds themselves in a shelter, it's important for us to find places close by. A lot of our transient populations, they're moving from North City to St. Charles to parts of St. Louis County, and the parents are so good, they don't really want to uproot their children's school. They keep their kid in the same school and try to find a way to get them there. And SLPS is required to find a way to get them to school every day, because we know the effect that changing schools in the middle of a school year and sometimes in the middle of a week can have a huge negative impact on any student, whether they're smart or not. And I think it's important for us to, when there is an emergency situation like that, a social worker is present that can find some emergency housing, whether through ready permanent housing, temporary housing, or some emergency shelter housing that's close by, to reduce the cost on SLPS and, most importantly, reduce the negative impact that has on the family. So there are a lot of different things we can do that partner with community organizations, but also partner with government organizations like St. Louis Housing Authority to make sure that we're getting the right housing for folks.
And you talked about education, but you also talked about a big thing about vacant housing. But what about vacant schools?
Yes.
This just sends me up a wall. I'm thinking about
I'm the
Hempstead
same.
School. I'm thinking of, there's so many schools now that are supposed to be real estate, but they're just eyesores now, particularly on the north side. Now, on the south side, they quickly, get them, and it is prime real estate, and they turn them into lofts and all of that. But these buildings on the north side, they're just there. And so, because the school, in some cases, have turned them over to somebody, nobody seems to be responsible for upkeep or, boarding up stuff or whatever. You're talking about eyesores and vacant buildings because they are huge. You got huge buildings that are just.
I have a saying, the only thing worse than a vacant house near a school building is a vacant school building near a house.
Right,
And we
right.
have several. I was in Mark Twain neighborhood the other week knocking doors and walked by the old Mark Twain school, which is absolutely vacant, burnt out several times, and it has to be demolished. That school can't be renovated into new residential property. And part of RAND's funding, there has been some provisions and some bills for large vacant buildings. That includes not just some large building downtown and improving it, but some large building in North City to help demolish it or renovate it if possible. And yes, I think that as I'm knocking doors, and I'm in parts of our city where we see where there's a vacant school in the middle of a neighborhood. That is a bigger eyesore to people who live right there. I was just driving by Fanning Middle School today, and my mouth dropped. Like, how long has Fanning been sitting like this in our city? And there are people that are living right around Fanning that I'm sure look at this every day and just can't believe it. It shows it. it gives an atmosphere that your city doesn't care.
It does. Absolutely.
And we've got to change that.
That's the message. And I keep people keep asking me, and of course I don't have the answer, like who's responsible for it? Is it the school, the city? Because you go to get to this thing where people like passing the buck and you don't know who it is. Like if I lived across the street from Mark Twain, who do I call to say, what are you going to do with this building? I mean, first of all, it's probably the older person you call, but then who do they call?
Well, the school district owns the building. The school district is responsible. And in a lot of cases, that there is a sign on that school building that shows the school district is responsible. But like will end up wanting to talk to the mayor. The job of mayor means that you are the top most powerful person in the municipality. And when you have $292 million of RAND money they know about, you don't have room for any excuses. And it becomes your responsibility. And I'm really willing and ready to take on that responsibility and to not give excuses. If you give me $1.3 billion and 5,000 employees, I won't give you back excuses. I'm going to give you results, and I'm definitely focused on reducing vacant housing and those vacant buildings like big school buildings.
When you talk about neighborhood stabilization, you have to see schools as a big part of that. And when there's big vacant buildings with, the shades flapping out of the windows, or, in the case of Hempstead School, lightning struck it and so it's burnt out. And it's just an eyesore and a terrible safety hazard to just be blunt about it. And so. And the thing I think is just sickening to me is that the number of schools online for demolition is growing. And I know part of that is based on student enrollment. I've gone through all of this with the school board and the superintendent. But at a certain point, we can forecast what student population is going to be in any given ward or any different school district. And so why don't we start planning then, like what can be done with this school before it becomes an eyesore? And it just seems like there's no vision for that. And it just drives me up a wall. I know one of the things you say with your campaign slogan is leadership you could trust and progress you could see. And you talk very definitively about the things that you've done. And if you were able to be mayor, what the city could look like and look differently. And when you talk about fairness, and because I see that as being part of an overall vision, what do you see as the biggest challenges here in this city? And it doesn't all seem to be about bricks and mortar.
Political culture that is the lose-lose in a lot of times. And I didn't grow up in this culture. I grew up in the Jeff City culture, which is for all it's talked about, it's much more professional. And there are times when there are times for a win-win. I grew up creating situations where where both sides can get a win. And I find that rare in St. Louis City from time to time. We
Why do
have
you think that is?
very aggressive New York and Chicago style politics that is more about respect than it is about results. And a lot of our politicians get caught up in nobody's going to respect me if I be nice rather than what the policy result could be. The second thing is, I used to say this when I was in Jefferson, and I come back and speak in neighborhood meetings. A lot of the issues in City Hall are black and white. In Jefferson City, they were very much policy based. They were conservative versus liberal versus progressive. And it's much harder to have a policy debate when folks are stuck on the color of their skin. And that has gone down a little bit in City Hall, thanks to folks like you, Jamala, and thanks to the uprising that occurred after the murder of Michael Brown, and thanks to the racial equity work that has been done over the past decade. But I see some of those themes coming back to our city hall, and that's part of it. The other thing is that there's the business community doesn't seem to have the same views and visions that the voting community has. And in this campaign, I've definitely seen a split between what the donor class wants and what the voting class wants. And I'm always on the side of voters. And I think that when a lot of the solutions that are portrayed for our city in the media and to politicians are things that donor class people want. And a lot of the solutions that I hear that are within reach, let me say, all the solutions that I hear that are always in within reach and that are doable come from the voting class. And even they have a vision for how to improve the riverfront. Even they have a vision for improving downtown. And these are the customer base that the business class depends on. And bridging that gap and using the power position as the mayor to bridge that gap between customers and business and voters and donors is something that a lot of Democrats across and Republicans and per se, but mostly Democrats across this country have to do better at. And I'm hoping I can be that American that can do
And I
that.
think that's especially the case when you got a Democratic city. What's the issue? I mean, I know what the issue is, but I guess the question is, why can't we bridge that gap or at least close it a bit so that it's not such a stark difference between what, as you say, the donor class want and what voters want? Because then what happens is they forge ahead with their self-interest, and that sometimes those interests step on our not just our interests, but our civil rights. And so now you got us up in arms. And so it's always this sort of back and forth, this push and pull, this tugging, that if people say, well, okay, we're getting ready to do a development over here, what do we need to consider? Who's living over there? What do they want? Whatever. I mean, it never happens like that, even though all the research says you got to have the community involved, and they might get pick out a couple of people and say, oh, we talked to Mr. Johnson and we talked to Ms. Jones, and they think this is a great idea. You see this stuff over time, and you just figure, okay, we're going through the cycle again. Like, we got a city now that is, as far as I'm concerned, manageable. You got 300,000 people. Most of the city where you know everybody's name. I mean, this is ridiculous.
I call it a big town. We're not a
I
small
do
city, we're
too.
a
I do
big old
too. I
town.
said a big town city. That's what I call it because it is small. And when you said there's New York and Chicago thinking, I'm like, where? I think it's more Mississippi thinking, this sort of southern parochial. Stuck in the past kind of thing. That's too radical. That's too, we can't do that. We can't do this. And as a result, we end up not doing very much. Like I do a lot of travel, Michael. And when I look at people's, for example, their riverfronts, booming. And they look at ours and I'm like, well, why come we can't do that? And there is that. Why come we can't have a booming riverfront?
Now we can, and that's where. So obviously, the state government is very much a second mover mentality, where the state government, which has more money than city government, is not an innovator. Coming through state government, their notion is always, well, has anyone done it before? How do we repeat it? And that's where the river. So anyway, that's where improving our riverfront can be something that comes from the state government, where we can utilize them. Maybe you can help with tax money to help us redo our riverfront. Why we haven't done this, to your point, is that those type of riverfronts have always include state and federal government investments. And the federal government already did an investment through the Arch Rounds. And that we had some federal US senators and congressmen who came together to put hundreds of millions of dollars to redo our Arch Rounds. And that was supposed to stir our state and our
Exactly.
business community to turn around and say, well, we'll build some things around it. And you're right, we haven't seen that kind of investment. Now, that's part of my vision for St. Louis when it comes to how it look differently outside of neighborhoods. Of course, I want to, number one, redo the biggest eyesore in the city, which is reducing the amount of vacant housing that people see all through our neighborhoods, especially coming down 70 when they're trying to come to our downtown to come around the city. But I want people to be able to look at our riverfront and say, wow, this is a place that we can go and live, work, and play. And this is a new shining space that has more space that we can be proud of.
Yeah. I know one of the things that, as you know, that I'm very much interested in, and that's the police department maintaining local control. and having the police be more accountable to the communities that they serve. And of course, one of the things that's been happening, at least for the last 4 years, maybe five, is the state has tried to take the city back. What is your position on local control? And I know that you were on the only candidate that thought that the police chief should not be getting subsidies from the police foundation. And I've been upset about that since day one. So I'm happy to hear that that's an issue you don't think is tenable. But here we are again at a place where they made it clear they want local control. And they've said it in so many ways. And when I think about the motto of the state about the will of the people, yada yada yada, I mean, it really just make a mockery of it, because they tried to undo just about every ballot initiative that we passed in the last like 2 years. But the police piece is really critical, because people to look at public safety very differently. And so I remember when we started the whole campaign around re-envisioning public safety, people didn't see a world without police. Oh, what's going to happen with? And now, since the police half the time don't even come, it's like, okay, we're already dealing without them, so maybe we can do without them. And so, what role do you see the police right now in 2025?
Against state takeover. That was your first question. And of course, I think that just as a voted people want control police department, and they want private or non-St. Louis interests outside out of their police department. They don't want the private companies paying for the salary of the police chief, and they don't want the governor appointing commissioners that are going to be more soft on Project 2025 than be soft on their cousin when they may just have a speeding ticket. So we've come a long way with racial equity, and come a long way over the past 10 years with trying to improve our police departments. And this is where I give the current mayor some kudos. The Office of Violence Prevention is something that was talked about for a long time and came out of a lot of the Ford through Ferguson and activist efforts. And it's had some success, and we've got to continue that success and bring some of that success into the funding to general revenue, and not just use ARPA funds. So reducing poverty and the root causes of crime, we know works, and we don't want a police department that doesn't believe that. And quite frankly, folks in Jefferson City, they believe in what Project 2025 wants to do, which is deport a lot of our citizens. And they want to incentivize the use of stop and frisk laws, and we don't want to go back. We don't want to go back to those times. We don't want that kind of policing. So I'm standing by our legislators who are fighting back against local control. I was in the state legislature when we got local control some years ago. I was part of the push to get us local control. I was very happy that our voters ended up voting for it. And we've had some success since. And once again, I don't think we know that Republican legislature does not view policing the same way that we do. They don't have the same those values that we have.
But the folks who are pushing for local control, most of them don't even live in the city of St. Louis. And so then that makes you know that it's not really about, they consider themselves not being safe because they don't even live here. They're in St. Charles, St. Peter's, or whatever. So it's really just a power play. And I'm thinking, you got somebody in the White House that executive orders that most people know who are enough to understand government, that some of this stuff is illegal. And when I say illegal, it's at least unconstitutional. But people don't seem to know what to do, because we've never had this situation before. So I'm just thinking about, as a mayor, how would you negotiate what's going on now with the White House, and the fact that a lot of the retaliatory stuff is towards, Democratic governors and Democratic mayors who don't bow down and kiss the ring. So how do you maintain a relationship with somebody as evil as that?
And I think it's important to understand that I won't have a direct relationship with the President of the United States, and that having been in leadership in the legislature and led leaders for a long time, I know how to find common ground and find commonalities that can then push U.S. senators or a president to make things happen. So there are two things. One, I think we have to leverage our two Republican U.S. senators and find ways we agree with them, but also push them by using the business community, who's very interested in reducing crime and may not agree with stop and frisk and may not agree with deportation laws or parts of Proposition 25. So the business leaders in St. Louis City that have a relationship with our U.S. senators, but also have share some of the same St. Louis values that we do. We've got to make sure we know which ones can influence, and that'll be prong one to make sure that we're utilizing our U.S. senators. Now, we do have two Democrat U.S. congressmen from Missouri, and one is very well loved, which is Congressman Cleaver. And utilizing my current relationship with Congressman Cleaver to support a larger Missouri or Midwest coalition on how to make sure we're pushing back against deportation. A lot of things are going to Kansas City, going to St. Louis too, and making sure we're utilizing that partnership more times than not. So partnering with national elected officials will be number one. Number two is that we have a federal lobbyist as a city, and we have a municipal mayor organizations and a national organization that can utilize where they have lobbying crews as well. So we can have a lobbying team that hopefully supports our St. Louis values and has similar values from Kansas City to Pittsburgh to Atlanta that we push back against as well, and build, in a sense, political organizing the same way that activists organizing. And that's the last thing. You got to partner with activists who are doing the work on the ground and who are real community people who are affected by this work and know their stories and tell their stories and partner with their plans to push back in DC. And Freeman Bozzi Jr. taught me this for a long time. He said there are three types of leaders. There are thinkers, there are compromisers, and there are executives. And the job of the noisemaker, the activist, a lot of times is to make way for the compromiser to make the deal that benefits the community. And the compromiser is always charged with getting the executive a job so that compromise stays in place and is executed for years to come. And part of why we sometimes don't get things done in St. Louis is that there are people who want to be all three. It's in our community, especially, they want to be all three. But it's not sexy to say, but I have found myself being the compromiser that is in conjunction with the noisemaker and is making space for the executive that can make sure that we get things done. And that'll be prong three, is making sure we're partnering with noisemakers that we're and that we're never disconnected from them or making compromises that they wouldn't agree with, or putting in a position where the organizations won't agree, but creating a space, a policy space, to where we can get an executive and get things done. And that'd be the third prong. I think you got to build community around a president, and you got to show some wins pretty fast against the things that he already knows is going to be super unpopular. And once you show those wins, then you're able to build upon those wins pretty quickly. And stop and frisk is going to come pretty soon. I think that's where we're going to see some wins pretty quickly. Deportation is where we can see a lot of activism and a lot of pushback, but we can definitely see some wins too. But our community definitely has to be prepared for a lot of the law enforcement pushback that we, from the gains we've made after the murder of Michael Brown.
Yeah. So in the few minutes that we have left, tell us how to get involved with your campaign, or the canvassing slots every week. Where can people give you a donation? What's going on?
Thank you. People can go to michaelbutler.org to access and see more about our campaign, as well as make a donation online. There's also a link to volunteer that goes directly to our Calendly link, which is a great Black-owned business, $3 billion company that's going to put you directly on our campaign
I didn't
calendar.
know that.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
I have to send you a link to his some of
Yeah.
his
I mean, I've
donations.
seen other people use it, but I didn't know it was black owned. Okay.
Yes. And so you can volunteer, get directly on our calendar to canvass with us, to make phone calls or work a shift for an early voting or an election day. And we're looking forward to seeing everyone who wants to be a part of our campaign.
Yeah, I always think elections are exciting, but sometimes they can get ugly. And I'm national. Have done a trickle down in terms of people's civility, and so I am concerned about racial divisions in St. Louis going forward. And so I think, whoever is setting the tone is whoever's going to set the tone. And we got a lot of underlying tensions racially in the city that are unresolved. And as soon as they get a chance to rear their ugly head, they do. And so I, I'm whoever is going to hold that office, you got a lot to hold and a lot to do. So good luck to you, Mike. Thank you for stopping by. And we'll definitely let people know how they can continue to get involved. And early voting started so people can go vote. They can, there's no excuse voting right now. So really, there's just no excuse for us not to be totally involved in these campaigns.
Sure. There's approved voting as well, so you can vote for more than one candidate in the primary. So you don't have, I'm not running against anyone. I'm just running with a good plan for our city, and you can vote for me or any other candidate you want, including the current mayor, Tashar Jones.
Absolutely. All righty. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we will be keeping an eye on March 4th. So
Yes,
thank you.
ma'am. Thank you. Great talking to you.
Well, we're expecting Mayor Jones to be with us last week, but because the university was shut down, there was no studio open. Mayor Jones will be with us next week, February 26th. So tune in. Thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. I will see you on the battlefield. I know you all were expecting Mayor Jones to be with us last week, but because the university was shut down, there was no studio open. Mayor Jones will be with us next week, February 26th. So tune in. Thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. I will see you on the battlefield.
Stop the fight, you've got to do it right. Stop the fussing right now.